Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to Voice of Vashon, webcast in real time at voiceofvashon.org, also available on archive and broadcast on Comcast Channel 21. For first-time listeners, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is a monthly show revolving around local and international guest authors who share with us how they see their fiction, memoir, or poetry playing an effective role in society through their readers. Thank you all for tuning in today as I chat with friend and fellow island author Will North, author of many, many books. So, Will, how was the commute today?
It was a typical frustrating 4 minutes. That's the beauty of living on this island. It doesn't take long to get anywhere.
I can relate. I had a similarly frustrating 11-minute commute. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's dive right in. While we will eventually get to your newly released novel, Season's End, there are a few things about your life that our friends and neighbors on the island may be surprised to learn. While you regularly delight us with op-eds in the local paper and acerbic conversation at the local coffee stand, I imagine many islanders may find it surprising that you actually had a life prior to moving to Vashon.
Yeah, it's really hard to believe. I'm old enough now that I can't even remember that life very easily. Everything, as far as I'm concerned, started when I got here 6 years ago. And frankly, I have no intention of leaving unless, you know, as a consequence of one of my wise guy columns in The Beachcomber, I get thrown out.
On this island? Yeah, potentially I could see that happening. Things get a little scary sometimes. But so let's do this. Let's take things chronologically. Would you be willing to share that amazing story that we talked about on the phone about your first job out of college in the world of journalism and the impact of that first story and what it did for you?
Well, it actually got me out of journalism is what it did, to be honest. So I got a graduate degree in journalism at a university in Pennsylvania. And I was immediately hired by the local newspaper in that county. And I wrote a three-part series, investigative series, in which at the end, two of the three county commissioners were thrown out of office because they were convicted of housing fraud for low-income people. And of course, the editor thought he had like the great white hope of journalism working for him. And it wasn't a month later I walked into his office and I said, look, I'm really embarrassed about this. I'm really sorry. I've just realized that journalism is like running across thin ice with the crack following you. The crack, of course, being the deadline. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I need to know more about what I'm writing, especially when it affects people, than I can do under these circumstances. And so I left. And that was the end of my journalism career.
So early on, you came face to face with the power of the pen, so to speak.
Yeah, and frankly, it frightened me to some extent. I just have always been the kind of person who wants to be absolutely accurate, whether it's in nonfiction or fiction.
Mm-hmm. I can as a columnist on the island, I really relate to what you're saying. And so from that experience, where did your focus on writing take you? I think for like the next 20 some odd years, you...
Yeah, one of the things that I stumbled into, as most of the things in my life I've stumbled into, was the environmental movement. I worked during graduate school at something called the Institute for Research on Land and Water Resources, and my job was to make understandable research on environmental issues that was being pioneered at this university. And I just loved writing about science. And that led to a career in natural resource planning, in public policy analysis, which ultimately ended up, roughly 10 years later, with an appointed position in the administration of Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
No one was more surprised than I, except perhaps my mother.
And from there, it's like, so on one hand, okay, you're doing policy work and, you know, you would be viewed by the layperson as working within the realms of sort of governance and planning. But then you went into this area of ghostwriting and nonfiction writing. And how did those two coalesce together?
Well, I always describe myself as a lifelong Democrat who's thinks that Ronald Reagan is God, and I think that because he fired me on the moment of Inauguration Day.
And really? On the day of?
Yeah, right, because I held an appointed position with Jimmy Carter, right. His predecessor, and that's how that works.
Right, 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 right.
And immediately a foundation in Washington, D.C. asked me to look into a particular subject, which had, again, to do with natural resource management and also economics. And so my first book was called Renewing America, Natural Resource Assets and State Economic Development. And that really got me started on a cycle of writing about public policy issues that were kind of coming over the horizon, being funded by foundations to do that work, writing the book, publishing the book, and then moving on to consult with governors in various states around the country about those ideas, mm-hmm. many of which, by the way, came from Europe.
Really?
Yeah. Here's an example. I think it was my second book. Is called Schoolworks, and it looks at how small countries in Europe help children coming out of secondary school find new paths to prosperity other than just college. Mm-hmm. In the United States, the only route to the future, if you're coming out of high school, is college. In other European countries, there are lots of other routes to solid, well-paying professions. Mm-hmm. So I studied those programs in a number of countries in Europe, and then turned around and wrote a book applying those ideas to systems here in the United States.
Wow. So prior to writing your first novel, you spent several decades being very successful on a personal business career level. You saw a lot, and you were involved in ghostwriting, nonfiction, all this stuff. So I am curious, before we delve into your current career as a fiction author, I'm curious what impact you saw these types of nonfiction books having upon society, especially the books that you wrote on behalf of various politicians, because I imagine they had a hoped-for outcome of releasing their story. So what was their purpose, and do you think the goal was achieved?
After I've written 4 or 5 books under my own name on different kinds of public policy issues, I got a call from Al Gore's office. He was vice president at the time. This was in the first Clinton administration. He liked the voice that I used in the nonfiction books, even though they covered fairly complicated subjects and economics and so forth. They also were really, really accessible. And he asked me to help him put together a book called Common Sense Government, which was about his efforts to change the way the federal government responds to the population's needs, sort of more customer-oriented federal government. Mm-hmm. I had finished that book. I typically never get more than about 3 months to ghost a book because it's generally, you know, urgent.
Right.
And it wasn't a month later that Clinton's office called and the president said, you know, I have this book I've been thinking about. I'd like you to help me. I like what you did with Al. So, you know, and I'm thinking, I just got back to Seattle. I'd really like to stay here, but it's hard to turn down a president.
Right.
And so I ghosted a book for him, which was called Between Hope and History. So over the course of those, what would that be, a decade and a half or something, I did a lot of this work about trying to help things get better economically, socially, in America. And somewhere along the line, I also wrote 3 off-the-beaten-track guidebooks to Britain. And I had this little epiphany, which was that when I was writing public policy work, even when I was ghosting for Bill Clinton, which was an amazing experience, the only thing really involved was my head.
Mm-hmm.
My heart wasn't really there. My heart was wanting to write other things. And then I also had to ask myself, is what I'm doing really making a difference in society? And I really wasn't certain.
Mm-hmm.
So I had written books about helping small firms become exporters. I had written books about helping young people get out of school and find a new profession. I had written books about reforming the federal government. I had a book that I did with Clinton, which was about where the country was going to go in the new millennium. Mm-hmm. And I was making a good living, and my customers were happy, but I wasn't sure whether it was actually hitting the ground mm-hmm. and making a real difference. When I wrote the travel books, I started getting mail. People who said that I had transformed their lives, their vacations were like unlike anything they had expected. And I said, I'm actually affecting people. I'm making them happier. And that worked for me.
Right. Hi, everyone. March here. I'm in the editing room. And as I've been working on my interview with Will North, this next little section came up, which I thought was pretty funny. And so I've left it in. This will give you a bit of a behind-the-scenes look at how things are done here at the Voice of Vashon studio during my interviews. Okie doke, enjoy. Okay, I'm going to squeak. I'm sitting in this chair in a way that's cutting off my blood flow. And I'm sitting here going, I love what he's saying. I will just suffer until he's done talking. Now I will edit. Okay. Now I can feel my leg, blood flowing back into those muscles. They are so happy. Okay. Thank you for that. Okay. So here we go.
How are we doing, by the way?
We're doing great.
Okay.
Let's see here.
I'm trying to edit the ahs out.
No. God, you're awesome. You're great. Don't worry about it. Okay. Hold on. Let me figure out where I'm at. There we go. Well, I can really relate. Sort of, what's the point of writing something if it doesn't actually have a valuable, or I mean, an impact that you notice and that you're like, yes, you know, I achieved something above just putting words on paper.
Well, remember, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and we were all involved, many of us were involved in social change. And I really cared about trying to provide opportunities for prosperity for people who were disadvantaged through interesting entrepreneurship programs and that sort of thing. But I truly couldn't tell mm-hmm. whether it was making a difference, and wasn't good enough for me.
And, you know, it's interesting that you made the comment that, you, like, the people who went on the vacation and they had this awesome experience and they're feeling, you know, this joy, and they take the time to write a letter. So in the political world, supposedly, if they receive a handwritten letter, they assume it represents potentially the opinions of 10,000 constituents, because so few people are actually going to take the time to write a letter and mail it. Now, if you just click on something in email and send it in, that's so much faster and easier that it's considered, it's weighted less as representing the will of the people, so to speak. But it's interesting, you know, some books, it's like with this radio show, I will have some people mention that they heard it, but my mother will be like, oh my gosh, March, you know, every time I go to the gym, someone's talking about that radio show, and wow, people are really enjoying it. And I'm like, well, I wish they'd like email me and tell me, you know. So sometimes in the world of putting ourselves out there, we don't always know if we're actually even hitting anything.
Well, so. And one of the things I think I learned in that experience as I got older is that you can change the world, but you have to do it individual by individual. Mm. You can't do it through, you know, massive intellectual concepts. Mm-hmm. But if you can improve somebody's life, anybody's life, somebody you don't even know, through your writing, then you've really made a contribution. It's small, but if everybody's making small contributions, they have weight.
Right. Absolutely. And ripple effects. So I was reading through your list of published works, and I'd like to illustrate for our listeners the breadth of topics you covered by running through a few of the titles, because I believe that your current pen name, I'm going to call it a pen name, Will North.
That's correct.
Okay. Would not be directly associated with some of these other titles. So if a person was looking up your name, they're not going to see all these come up on a Google search.
Exactly.
So let's go ahead, and I can't cover the entire list, but please give us snippet comments sort of about each title. You've mentioned a couple of them already. And so here we go. Pop quiz, as it were. Okay, so you mentioned Renewing America, Natural Resource Assets, and State Economic Development. that was geared towards what, people within government?
It was, but it had a fundamental economic concept at its heart. I was concerned about using the income from the management and use of renewable resources. Let me rephrase that.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in using the income states and the federal government were getting from the use of non-renewable resources to take that income and reinvest it in renewable resources with a very simple concept. If you think of renewable resources as a piece of equipment, a piece of capital equipment, right? Well, like a tractor on the island. You know, if you want to keep that tractor going, you have to keep investing in it, keep it managed, upkeep, clean it up, feed it fuel, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
No reason to not think of renewable natural resources in the same way. Manage the forests, manage the rangelands, manage wildlife such that the benefits continue in the future rather than being degraded.
You know, that's really fascinating to hear you say that, because one of the things that I mention when I'm in conversation with someone about non-renewables, so fossil fuels and whatnot, is I'll say to them, the real gift that we've received by discovering these, you know, fuel sources, coal, oil, whatever, they are this massive source of easily accessible power. But if we spend 300 years as our species on this planet using it to make a bunch of plastic toys and who knows what, and then it's all gone, and we haven't used it to catapult ourselves into a sustainable system of renewables, well, then we don't have another big pile of oil to go dig up out of the ocean and try it again. It's almost as if the only benefit we could get that would be long-lasting would be to convert the non-renewables into creating a renewable system of life that could go on in the future.
And my objective with that book was to take that argument out of the world of environmentalism and into the world of economics.
Mm-hmm.
And curiously, a number of my early books were actually published by the Brookings Institution, which is the country's probably premier economics think tank in Washington, D.C., which all of my economics friends are annoyed about because I have no economics degree. But I can make economics understandable, and that's the difference.
Yeah. I'm working with a scientist this weekend to help him take what he understands scientifically and write it in a way that the people on the island are going to be able to understand the message, because for the last few weeks, it has not been coming across. And I'm like, dude, if I'm not getting it, no one else is getting it. And he's like, I know. And I'm like, okay, let me help you. So yeah, knowing it and being able to write it so it's hearable, those are two different skills.
Well, and I just tell the people that I work for, I'm not that bright. I can't understand this stuff. So I'm going to use really small words to make it understandable for me.
Right. Okay. So then SchoolWorks was the one that you talked about already, taking examples from how Europe expands
the range of opportunities post-secondary school kids. Yeah.
Beautiful. And then there's Going Global.
Well, at the time I wrote that, researchers had discovered that the vast majority of new jobs were being created by small and medium-sized enterprises.
Mm-hmm.
And those enterprises in a global, increasingly globalizing economy are only going to be able to succeed if they export, but they have no experience in it.
Mm.
And so it occurred to me that if you went to countries that had very small domestic economies, their businesses would have no choice but to export in order to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to a number of countries around Europe and also Scandinavia and looked at what they did to train very small companies to become global competitors. And then we came back across the Atlantic, if you will, with those ideas and started promoting them with governors of various states.
That almost brings to mind, I think, so I'm not going to remember the name of it, but we have that business on the island where they're creating stoves. They've like brought the brains together to create these amazing stoves, and then they're actually exporting the technology and the idea to Africa, where it'll prevent people from needing to cut down their forests to burn open fires.
Right.
So that's an example almost of a small business that couldn't sell those stoves here on Vashon and make a living, but through using export business strategy, they're able to be a successful business and potentially improve the entire world by preserving forests.
that's the only way that small and medium-sized enterprises are going to be able to continue to employ the people that they employ by finding new markets elsewhere. But it takes a lot of training to learn how to do that effectively. And what I was seeing in Europe were very, very smart programs to help businesses do that.
Okay. So then we have the development report card for the states.
Oh, this was a lot of fun. I worked for a number of years as a consultant to an organization called the Corporation for Enterprise Development. Its objective was to help disadvantaged people in states around the country to achieve success through enterprise development. In fact, they actually changed the federal law on unemployment insurance so that if instead of just taking a monthly unemployment check, you had the option to be able to take a bulk payment in order to start a new business if you had an approved business plan. That was a huge change, and it got people off of being essentially on the dole. The development report card for the states that this organization began thinking about had to do with the way states then were marketing themselves as having a good climate for business. Hugely political subject in every state legislature, and including our own. And what we realized was that those states were essentially pretending to be a good place to work and to found a business or to relocate a business if you had really poor labor laws, very lax environmental standards, a not particularly bright workforce, people who wouldn't demand too much of the company. And we said, you know, if and we looked at the list that another organization, a business organization, prepared every year, and we said, so if Mississippi is the best business climate in the country, why are they at the bottom?
That's interesting, right?
And if New York or California or even a place like Washington is not a good place to found a business or to relocate a business, why are they at the top in income, in employment, and any number of other economic and also social measures?
King County, I believe, if you were to rank King County's basically like gross national product or the income of the county compared to the states of the union, I think we're like number seven. Like we trump, 43 of the states of the union just as a county. And yet people say, oh, it's so bad for business. It's like, well, somehow things, okay, that is an interesting dichotomy.
Well, I'm saying the Corporation for Enterprise Development, came up with several dozen measures for ascertaining the health of state economies. And what I loved about the job was like being Sherlock Holmes. They would give me stacks and stacks of computer printouts, and I'd go through all of these numbers trying to find the stories and try to understand why it was that this place was doing really, really well, that place was not doing very well, and trying to find the correlates.
Right.
And to me, it was like a game every year.
Right. Okay, so, wow. Okay, so these are examples really of sort of that first stage. This is very, well, some people would say this was dry material. I mean, you're passionate about it. People in governance and are going to be passionate about it. Maybe the average person wanting to sit by the pool on a summer day and relax may not want to read something of that topic. So we have like...
It's a different audience.
So we have like in the brain, you know, up in the head, like you were talking about earlier, it didn't really hit your heart. It was up in the head. And then you said that you had that epiphany a bit about, you know, who's benefiting the most because you started to shift. And we have, you know, you have other books, but there's like The Best of Britain's Countryside, Ghosts of Everest, which makes me wonder, like, were you an experienced mountain climber back in the day?
No, not then and not now. I've always said that I'm not an artist, I'm a tradesman. I carry around a toolbox, and the toolbox is full of the stuff that I use in order to write, research and write. And what I've discovered over a lifetime is that I can use those tools on anything. There is a story, which you may want to keep in this piece or edit out. I'm not sure. But I had a partner who had two sons. This was in Seattle. She was involved with the Mountaineers Club. We're at a dinner party across the street when one of her kids runs in and yells, "They found the body." And I'm thinking, what, the one in the basement? I mean, what body are we talking about? And this lady leans over to me and she says, I signed this team of explorers to look for the body of George Mallory and his climbing partner, Sandy Irvin, who disappeared on the mountain in 1924. They were the first explorers of Everest, and they found Mallory.
Wow.
And she said, you know what that means? And I said, so, like, he's still dead, right? And she said, no, it means I need a book in 3 months.
Oh, my God. Was this person just a friend, or was this your agent? Or
she was my partner.
Okay, got it. Oh, right, right. Like, I need that book, and I need it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you shifted, but it was a shift from maybe what some would call dry material, but it isn't. But you know what I'm saying. That to maybe broader public, popular audience. I mean, everyone is interested in Everest, books about Everest, you know, they're really enjoyable. People are fascinated. You have The Lost Dinosaurs of Egypt. And then you have this one. Oh, I love this. Surely this would be a hit with our Vashon Island community, which is Green Goes With Everything.
Yes. Consumer reporter in San Francisco came across me. I don't know how. And she said, I want to do this book about green living. She had had a personal experience in that she had a son who was chronically sick with allergies and asthma. And she discovered by a process of elimination that it was the things in her house, the cleaning materials that they used, all sorts of materials that everybody has in their house. Mm-hmm. And the more they removed those items, the healthier the boy became.
Awesome.
To the point that his asthma just vanished.
Oh, that's
and
great.
So she and I worked together for several months to go through essentially all of the categories of items that you might use in a day-to-day life,
right,
and research in depth what their potential dangers were.
Mm-hmm.
Like the white coating on the inside of canned goods, which actually can have a substantial health effect over the long term.
Interesting.
So that's how that book ended up happening.
So all of these so far, they still fall within the range of nonfiction because we're not hearing about a protagonist and it's not a fictionalized story. And what happened a few years ago was sort of you made that switch. So writers often will talk, this is for all of our listeners who have not chosen to write a book, but you love reading them, you're going to know what I'm talking about. Writers often talk about the inciting incident in a novel, that pivotal experience, whether it's fantastical or traumatic or maybe utterly confusing, which often leads the main character to take action, showing his or her true grit or inner strength, and really gets the story rolling. Well, obviously, inciting incidents happen in real people in real life as well. In fact, all of the authors I've interviewed so far have an inciting incident pretty much linked to all of the books they've written. They're, you know, like, it's like, oh, well, where do you get your ideas? Well, there was something that happened in my life, and this was the inciting incident, and then bam. So,
whenever anybody asks me where I get my ideas, I always tell them Toledo.
Right.
It's just such a silly question.
well, and yet there are also books out there saying, here's how you can find ideas. So I think readers are like, well, there must be some magic thing going on. But most people who are going to spend 3 years or however long it is working on a novel, there has to be like a pretty important reason why they're really interested in that story. So there was an inciting incident in your life, which I'd love to have you talk about, which seems to have launched you out of this entire previous genre of nonfiction and smack dab into the deep end of the fiction writing swimming pool.
And nobody was more surprised than me.
Could you share this with us?
Yes. I had been married for 14 years to an absolutely splendid, splendid woman, quite a fairly well-known fashion designer, and just a delight to live with. We divorced. Why we divorced is a long story, but it had to do with both of us saying, we love each other madly, but this is not working out as a partnership. But we were on the phone every week for another 10 years, at which point she got breast cancer. And they were not able to save her. And so I spent the last 2 months of her life on the other side of the country taking care of her until the day she died. And to my very great surprise, she had in her last will and testament the request that I scatter her ashes atop a mountain that we had climbed years earlier in Wales, in the Snowdonia area of North Wales. Mm-hmm. And I did that. I took the ashes, scattered them atop the mountain. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done. It was really letting go of her then, finally. And I came back, and about, I don't know, a month later, I sat up in bed, literally sat up in bed one morning, gave my forehead a dope slap and mm-hmm. said, "You idiot, you know, there's a novel sitting here. All you have to do is write it."
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me just say that although that bit of that story is autobiographical, that's only about the first 10% of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else about that story, which is a love story, mm-hmm. A complicated love story involving the ex-husband and yet another woman
mm-hmm.
Who ran a bed and breakfast at the foot of the mountain, mm-hmm. It just happened. I mean, it just mm-hmm. happened. These characters show up, scenes show up, and sometimes I feel like I'm just taking dictation.
And you don't mean that it happened in real life. You mean the first 10% was autobiographical and everything after that
is fiction.
It flowed and it's fiction.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
But that experience...
No, I didn't fall in love with Fiona.
Right.
There was no Fiona.
Right. But you had this real sort of christening almost experience of the next, you know, with the passing and the ashes and all that. And then out of that emotional depths of your life experience came this flicker of light that turned into which novel?
The Long Walk Home.
Right, which is your first.
Yes.
Yes. And this is the one that you, like, just wrote in 3 months. It just flew out of you.
Yeah, 90 days.
Yep.
Yeah. Again, I had never written, knowingly written, a sentence of fiction in my life. I'd never taken a creative writing class.
Right.
But this book just exploded out of me. I sent it to my agent, and literally, and this is completely unheard of, as a first novelist, within
right.
2 weeks, there were four major New York publishers in an auction bidding mm-hmm. for the rights to the book. And I just sat in my chair at home and just shook my head and said, "These people are nuts."
Well, maybe not. Okay, so you currently have, within the world of fiction, you currently have two novels which have actually been just recently re-released, and what that means is that they were released, this is the first one, a few years ago, but after the near collapse of the publishing world since 2008, where lots of beautiful books just suddenly disappeared because, like, their parent publishing company died, that you've regained the rights to those two novels, and you've re-released them, and they are... The Long Walk Home, and
Waterstone Heart.
Right. And then in addition, right now you're currently involved in the promotion work for your newly released novel, Season's End, which is the one based here on Vashon Island.
That's right. The first two books are both set in the United Kingdom. Why are they set in the United Kingdom? Because for all of my life until 6 years ago, the only place I ever felt at home, the only place I ever felt like I belonged, was England.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not English. I don't believe in past lives. I just felt that way the moment I got there back in the late 60s, and
right.
it's been that way ever since. Mm-hmm. Then I came to Vashon.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally came over on the ferry one day to visit with a friend for a week and never left because I knew instantly that I
right.
belonged here. So while previous books have been set in the United Kingdom and subsequent books will be set in the United Kingdom, this one is strictly Vashon.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I'm sure you've heard them as well, the stories of how people came to this island. And there's the rain. I mean, I know people who were subscribing to the Beachcomber for 2 years while they lived in Hawaii because somehow they knew, and they'd never even been here, they just knew they wanted to come to Vashon Island. And I'm always like, I'm like you. I didn't even know the island existed. And then one day there was a nature program, and I was in West Seattle, and I wanted my son to be able to do this. And I just came over, and literally 2 months later, we had sold our house in West Seattle in 15 days by ourselves and purchased a house here on the island. It was just like everything. My husband had been working out of the home, commuting to Redmond, and he got a phone call like the day I told him I wanted to live on Vashon from his boss saying that they want him to start working from home again. which would mean he wouldn't have to commute on and off island. It was like in 2 months, the universe just said, bam.
You know, I actually have a book that I have been working on part-time now for about 5 years, which is called The Anatomy of Home.
Oh.
And it aims to explore the question, what do we mean when we say we feel at home someplace?
Right.
What's that made of? Do not tell me that it's a place you feel comfortable. I want to know every one of the little bits and pieces of experience that gives you that sense of belonging here and not somewhere else.
Right, right. Why is Redmond or Bellevue not home?
Well, it's placeless. Those places are placeless. You could be helicoptered into them, have no idea where you are.
Right, yeah.
Whereas Vashon has a clear sense of place.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm a massive fan of living here, and I always tell people it's not the island, it's the people. You know, because there's lots
yes.
of places that look like this
yes.
on an environmental level. And yes, being an island is a big piece of that. But I mean, it's not necessarily the moss or the trees, because those are in many places. There's something energetically about Vashon and the people who choose to come here.
Well, I've always thought that Vashon is a low security lunatic asylum.
I mean, I don't disagree.
Amazing number of characters on this island, and they make it what it is.
So often I'll think to myself, this is what all those great books were written about when we grew up, you know, whether it's Little House on the Prairie or whatever. When you read a story, Mrs. Pigglewiggle, right, that you love, it's those crazy characters. It's the grumpy storekeeper or the, you know, the postal woman who delivers flowers. I mean, you know, who cares what it is? It's the oddities and the strange elements of us that make the story.
And there are plenty of those people in Season's End, my Vashon book. Uh-huh. Only one of them is clearly recognizable as a real person in Vashon, and readers can pretty much sort that out on their own.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of them are totally made up, but just as crazy.
And so, right, that's perfect, because I was just going to ask you, you brought an excerpt to read from Season's End, correct?
I can do that.
I would love it if you'd do it right now.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. At first, he thought it was a deer. It was not quite morning on what promised to be yet another brilliant end of summer day. The pre-dawn fog was just beginning to lift. Not that it actually lifted. Not that it was fog, either, come to that. That's just what islanders called the queer maritime phenomenon, because marine layer was too fussy a phrase to use for an everyday event. In the wee hours, it lay like a lid 100 feet or so above the ground in late summer, and as the upper air warmed, plumes of mist descended and rose, twisting wraith-like through the feathered branches of the firs that cloaked the island. Then, at a certain but highly uncertain point later in the morning, the regulars at the Burton coffee stand sometimes bet on the precise moment, it simply disappeared like steam from the manhole covers in Manhattan streets he remembered from his childhood. The fog didn't move off the way clouds do. Instead, in a sort of meteorological sleight of hand, it just vanished. You missed it entirely if you didn't pay attention. Colin Ryan paid attention. Though it was only the first Monday of September 2012 and the night had been warm, on this morning's bike ride, Colin could already sense the coming autumn chill. It was there in the sharper tang of the air that swept in from the Pacific, and in the subtle shift in the quality of the light as the transit of the sun took a lower, more southerly route across the sky. It was there in the way the echoing honks of migrating geese began to replace the shrieks of laughter of children who summered on the beach. It was there in the way the leaves of the alders and broad-leaf maples on this mostly evergreen island would, in a matter of a few weeks, not so much change color as slowly lighten as they died, reverting to the pale greens of spring, as if the movie of the seasons was playing backward. Summer didn't flame out in the Pacific Northwest as it did in Colin's native Northeast. It slipped gracefully off stage. And here, in the middle of Puget Sound, surrounded by the perpetually snow-capped Olympic Mountains to the west and the Cascades to the east, Colin thought this perfectly appropriate. Flash was unnecessary when grandeur was everywhere. But in the thin half-light of dawn, he could tell that the end was approaching, the gathering autumn already sucking the marrow from the fat bones of summer. There were still warm days, though, and he was taking full advantage. He was nearing the end of his pre-dawn ride, an 8-mile circumnavigation of the southern half of the island, something he did every morning before opening the clinic as long as the weather held. It had been nearly 2 decades since he'd moved to the island to take over the local veterinary practice. Colin was hunched over his handlebars and speeding down the steep, sinuous stretch of the Vashon Highway just south of the little hamlet called Burton, the tires of his touring bike hissing over the dew-damped asphalt like tape being ripped from a dispenser, when he saw the dark mass ahead in the middle of the road. Deer were a year-round menace on Vashon Island, but the danger worsened as fall approached. As if in their frenzy to pack on as much weight as possible to carry them through the winter, the beasts had become senseless to danger whenever they saw an irresistible patch of grass. Given the dark canopy of the conifer forest, many of these irresistible patches were along the sunny margins of the island's narrow roads. Colin squeezed his brake levers hard, slid to a stop on the slick pavement at a point just where the road leveled out along the north shore of Outer Quartermaster Harbor. In the dim light just pearling the sky to the east, he noticed a great blue heron hunched on an arm of driftwood at the water's edge, motionless as an undertaker. He unclipped from the pedals, leaned his bike against the guardrail, and crossed the road, his cycling shoes clicking on the pavement like a metronome. In another half hour, traffic from the morning's first Tacoma-bound ferry to the south end of the island would pick up, and even though it was Labor Day, the now deserted road would get busy. Colin knew he'd have to drag the deer to the side of the road so there wouldn't be another accident. It wasn't the first time he'd done it. He wondered what happened to the car that hit the beast. At this hour, it would have been an old beater of a pickup belonging to an island laborer, the kind of fellow least likely to be able to afford repairs, the most economically vulnerable to any accident, whether personal or vehicular. They often had a well-loved old dog who rode with them, and Colin took care of their animals when they were sick, often for nothing. As he came closer to the carcass on the asphalt, though, he realized, even in the dim pre-dawn light, that there was a problem with this particular deer. Instead of the usual flea-bitten russet coat, this one was wearing a short black cocktail dress and silver high-heeled sandals, and wasn't a deer. The body lay on its back, but the head was turned away, the face curtained behind a swirl of sun-streaked ash-blonde hair. The slender tan limbs lay splayed like a child's pickup sticks. He didn't need to see the face. He recognized the dress. He'd admired it and the woman who wore it only hours earlier at the annual beachside party the old summer families always held the night before Labor Day, the day before they all left the island for the winter. The body belonged to Martha Peterson Strong, known to everyone on the beach as Pete. He'd known her and loved her for more than 20 years.
Oh, you know, I just love your ability to capture the place. And of course, you just got it. That's like, I'm just like, so Vashon. But on top of all of that, there's that first sentence. I mean, how did you come up with that? And repeat it just so the listeners can remember what it was.
The first sentence is, at first he thought it was a deer.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out about 5 years ago, I was driving north on the Vashon Highway towards Burton, from my then girlfriend's house, now my wife. And it was mostly dark, and I was screaming around the bend and got to the flats just before you go up into Burton. Mm-hmm. And there was something in the middle of the road, and at first I thought it was a deer.
Mm-hmm.
It was a woman.
And so talk about an inciting incident.
Yes. And I couldn't get that notion, that idea, that sentence right out of my head. It took me 5 years.
Right.
But eventually it became the beginning of the novel.
At first.
And by the way, the woman was okay.
Right, yes, yes, thankfully.
The one in the real life, that is.
Right. The one that you came across, yeah.
And thought was a deer.
You're coming along and all the emotions that would go through you when you suddenly realize, that's not a deer, it's a person. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so, wow. Now, clearly, once the genie was out of the bottle, once you were sort of unhinged, so to speak, and released.
I think most of the people at the Burton coffee stand would describe me as unhinged.
Right.
And that's just fine with me.
So once you were unhinged and released into what has turned out to be your, I don't even know how to say this, you know, you just found fiction in your life, your form of fiction. You've never turned back at this point, right?
Well, that's because it's way more fun. It's a whole lot harder, but it is way more fun. It's really hard to describe how much of what happens, at least in my case, in writing fiction, that turns out to just be a surprise every day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't outline my books.
Mm-hmm.
I tried that once. It felt like being in a straitjacket.
Oh, I couldn't do it either.
And so I typically begin with three things. A setting,
mm-hmm.
A place that really talks to me, that really moves me. A couple of characters, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, some theme that I'm exploring through fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the theme, I don't even understand what the theme is until I'm well into the book.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, there's always a fundamental theme about human relations.
Right, right.
In the case of the first book, The Long Walk Home, it turned out that that book was really about the incredible complexity of the concept of fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have characters who are wrestling with the notion of fidelity to a spouse, fidelity to the last wishes of an ex-spouse, mm-hmm. Fidelity to a set of moral principles that you've mm-hmm. loved, that you've lived with all your life, and then fidelity to this new love that shows up that is just overwhelming. How do you choose?
Right. Well, and that's part of what prose, poetry, and purpose is about, which actually reminds me that I'm going to go ahead and mention for our listeners who might just now be tuning in that you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon at voiceofvashon.org. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm talking today with Will North, author of many books, including the newly released novel Season's End. And one of the things that I've heard you talk about before, and I just want you to touch on this quickly because I'm looking at the clock and I'm like, is that I often say that there are as many writers as there are readers. There is, however, a difference between those who write for personal benefit or enjoyment, like my mom, who has the most beautiful and amazing journals, to those who decide to make a career out of it, those of us who are crazy enough to try to do that. Could you talk a bit just about how you bring professionalism to your writing and that it is, you know, it may be art, but it's also a job?
Well, the first thing I would say is that when people say, how did you turn out to be a writer? I confess that I'm just incompetent at everything else. You know, I have one trick, and I can write, and I can write well, and I've learned enough over many, many years
mm-hmm.
That it is like a trade, or it's like learning to play the piano. Mm-hmm. The more you work at it, the better you're going to become. It's practice, practice, practice. It's like when they ask, you know, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? And the guy on the corner says, practice. And truly,
yeah.
You know, you just keep at it.
Right.
There's that, and there's just the discipline of sticking yourself in the chair and cranking out a couple of thousand words a day
mm-hmm.
and not being distracted by anything else. If that's the source of your mortgage payment, the distractions are easy to ignore.
Right. No, that's an excellent point. I mean, I'm well into the third revision currently of my novel, The Ghost Lords, which I have worked on steadily for 3 years. And I really appreciate, you know, your focus on dedication to one's craft that it's, you know, we hear the stories of, oh, you know, I had a dream, I woke up, and you know, 6 months later, I had this, you know, nationally renowned, fabulous, you know, book, and I'm making, you know, millions of dollars. Most of us work a little bit harder than that. Even if the book comes out quickly, revision work is intense.
Well, I got lucky in that because of having ghostwritten so many books on really, really short timetables,
mm-hmm.
I learned the trick of having my first draft be my final draft.
Mm.
I very seldom revise my books.
Oh.
What I do every morning is read through what I wrote the day before,
right,
and clean it up and then push ahead, mm-hmm, because I've always got that clock ticking in the back of my head. As an ex-New Yorker, I describe what I do as being in the Holland Tunnel, which is a tunnel between Manhattan and New Jersey,
right,
or New Jersey, as we say there.
Right.
And the whole objective is to keep the lights in the tunnel going by in your car at the same rate of speed, right, so that you get to the other side.
Yeah, movement's good.
And that's how I feel when I'm writing, is that I'm moving forward constantly,
mm-hmm,
keeping those lights going by, because right, that's the only way it's going to get done.
Right, right. Exactly.
But let me add one more thing.
Yeah.
I mentioned surprise a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The real joy is that it's as if the Holland Tunnel had curves, and you never know what's around the next curve.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always a surprise. My second novel, Waterstone Heart, I was on, I think, the third page of the first chapter. You'd think I'd know where I was going.
Maybe.
And this little kid shows up, right? This little girl, 8-year-old girl shows up, and I'm looking around my office and saying, what are you doing in my book?
Mm-hmm.
Get out of here. And she basically takes over the book.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea she was going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Total surprise.
Mm-hmm.
That's magic.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the hard-to-explain reality, in a way, right? It's like it happens, and not everything can be explained away with deductive logic, necessarily. So we're going to delve just a little bit deeper into your goals for improving the world in a way through your writing. Now, there was the very direct, I'm going to write a book about how we can do this better and at government level and da da da. And now we get to the role of fiction and how an author can improve the world through the impact they have on their readers. For example, Green Goes With Everything certainly gives good advice and encourages people to go green in their lifestyle and explains how it can improve things. But I would like to know how you think a reader might respond differently to reading a novel where they're in the shoes of the character, whether it's the child with the asthma or the mother who's desperately trying to resolve the situation and the inhalers just aren't working and the trips to the hospital aren't working, and, you know, experiencing more firsthand a person's adventure as they overcome this difficulty. And what's the takeaway message that a reader is going to walk away with when they've had a fictionalized experience and gone through that? How do you see the difference between nonfiction and fiction?
Well,
not one better than the other, just the difference.
Well, I think the clearest answer is that in my books, at least, my fiction books at least, I'm exploring the human condition.
Right.
I'm taking an issue that I believe all of us deals with at one point or another and trying to explore through characters and situations how that might play out. In my second novel, Waterstone Heart, the underlying subject is the barriers, the walls that people build around themselves, believing they'll be protected by those walls, and just how fragile they really are. I also explore a subject that's close to my heart, which is best framed as a question, which is, how does a woman who was sexually abused as a child ever find the trust and the courage,
mm-hmm,
to form an intimate relationship with a man in adulthood? That's something I have had to deal with in my own life with partners, and it's brutally difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to just see what it would take. You know, what series of events would permit someone to build and accept that trust.
Right.
In the new book, in The Season's End, the subject is sort of how generations of the histories of three families can be eliminated literally overnight on a single Labor Day weekend through a series of betrayals,
mm-hmm,
that changes everything.
Right. And we don't want to give away too much about
no.
that, do we? No. So,
but all three, let me just say one thing. Yeah. All three of them are fundamentally love stories for grown-ups.
Right. Definitely. Well, mature content, but not like not okay for teenagers. I mean, just...
No. These are not romance novels. They're not bodice rippers.
No. Oh, I know. Can you imagine? Okay. Yeah.
If they were, I'd probably be very rich, but...
Okay. So, well, in addition to that, I hear that you are now killing people.
I am. I've always wanted to kill people. I think that's part of the human condition, too. Mm. Only I do it in fiction.
Yeah, thank goodness.
I've always loved reading murder mysteries, particularly those that are set in England. And I won't go through all of the golden age of, you know, English murder mystery writers and so forth, but I've always really enjoyed them. And I thought, well, why don't I do that if I like them so much?
Right.
So the next book, which is called Harm None.
Right.
And
that's
the
book that I read for you about a year ago,
I
think.
Yeah. That's right.
I'm looking forward to seeing that in print.
By the time this broadcast is broadcast, it mm-hmm. should be out.
That's June.
I believe so.
So this
summer.
It
should probably be out just before that.
Awesome. I will make sure that we put out some information. I mean, this will be coming out that time, but I also it'll definitely be on the website and people will have that information.
And this book is actually the first in a series that's set in Cornwall, England, the far southwestern tip, and will have a continuing cast of characters.
And the continuing cast of characters, I'm just checking, is pretty much the is it going to be like the, what do you call them? I don't know, the investigator, the police
investigative
person.
Team.
It's not the other people. I don't want to give anything away.
No,
but it's not
no.
the people in the first scene.
No.
Okay.
No, it's the investigative team.
I like that character.
A lead detective inspector who is a woman,
mm-hmm.
irascible, difficult.
She's great.
And a scene of the crimes manager who is her complete opposite, just a peach of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that because I had such history in writing nonfiction, I am just passionate about accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a whole team of advisors in Cornwall mm-hmm. who hold those positions, who sort out when I get something procedurally wrong.
Right. I'm not going to give anything away. Okay. All right. So I have one final question, which I typically pose to all of my authors before we run out of time. For all of our listeners, but especially for those who are facing challenges in their life and who may wonder whether they'll be able to overcome those challenges, what message of hope can they expect to find in your novels?
I found that message through the very process of writing them. And I discovered that I believe in second chances in love and in life. And all you have to do is have the courage to grab them.
Hmm. Second chances. Well, let's certainly hope we've got second chances in many places in this world, because I think we need them. Definitely. Okay. So for those interested in learning more, you can reach Will North directly at his website, www.willnorthonline.com. And unlike some people who are hard to reach, he is great at responding quickly. And you can also learn more about his novels, the newly released novel, Season's End, the upcoming mystery series. And, Will, I just really appreciate your willingness to share yourself, your time, and your work with the rest of us.
Well, it's just a joy to be here. It's grand. Thank you.
It has been really fun. To all my listeners, I'd like to thank you as well for listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose and mentioning this show to your friends so that they can come and join us. My name is March Twisdale, program host and producer. If you have a favorite author who inspires you to believe in yourself and the future, please send me an email at marchpower@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Special appreciations to all of those who make Voice of Vashon the wondrous local radio station that it is, whether through direct involvement or their generous financial support, and my guest authors for their passion, which sustains them as they spend years writing novels, which we can read over a weekend. And now here's our island's own Cami Lundeen and her fabulous title song, Run Free, one more example of inspiration through art.
the mountains, like the sun sets beyond the sea, like the wind blows through the trees on a crisp autumn evening, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. Run free and be who you were made to be. Run wild and find the beauty that hides, hides inside, that hides inside. Like the moon floats in the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on a stormy